I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The world's leaders are getting together in the UK at the end of this month to discuss how to tackle climate change. Meanwhile, fuel prices are rising higher and higher. Oil prices are now over $85 and they continue to rise to $100 maybe. In the UK and Europe, gas is the problem. It's pushing up the price of heating and some factories are having to close because their operations are no longer profitable. Gas prices are way higher than when they peaked in 2008. It's constrained supply that's the issue, partially because renewables are not performing as much as they might. In fact, wind, solar and hydro production has all fallen in the UK this year, whilst demand for power has increased. So we're facing an energy crunch. And how do we get out of it? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Well, one way of getting out of this energy crunch is to use more coal and oil, and that's certainly what they're doing in China. In fact, in the UK as well, in Q2 this year, demand for energy increased by a quarter. Demand for petrol increased 41%, for gas by 25%, but electricity fell by 8%. Gas, the problem there was, whilst demand rose by a quarter, production fell by 41%, making the UK more reliant on imports, mainly from Russia, and hence the price crunch. And electricity production fell because renewable electricity generation fell. We had a 14% fall in Q2 in wind generation because of lower average wind speeds, and solar and hydro were also down because of the weather. Now, some of us have come to the realisation that this is all short term. The long term, if we're going to help prevent climate change getting considerably worse, then we're going to have to consume less energy. Other people think that we can do it by simply switching to renewables without really compromising our lifestyle. Well, that doesn't seem to be working too well for us at the moment, does it? Boris Johnson is one of those people who thinks that can be achieved, though. But the UK this winter is going to be a country where it seems people will have to choose between whether they use energy or whether they consume food. Take your pick. I mean, Steve, even if we stuck with our current energy levels, can we really replace fossil fuels with renewables? It's not going too well at the moment.
Yeah, it's a big ask, and the thing is we've got nowhere near it. And in fact, when you look at what we call not so much renewable, but non-CO2 energy sources, fundamentally the major factor in that has been hydro for a long, long time. And then because of a substantial number of European countries went the nuclear route, particularly France, back in the 50s and early 60s, it's also nuclear. Now, we've had declining levels of nuclear, no increase in hydro for since probably the 70s, and the result is that the level of renewable energy as part of total energy at the global level has never got past 15%. So 85% of what we consume in terms of energy is fossil fuel-based. And
What are your thoughts on nuclear? Do you think it's a one alternative?
Yeah, I mean, I did my demos against nuclear power and nuclear weapons back in my youth, as most progressive,
everyone did.
Most lefties end up doing. That's true. and I was my point was always sort of a physics point, that how can you have a power station which is being irradiated, where the irradiation is going to damage the actual container vessels over time? How do you actually make that work in a reliable way? And so it's more of an engineering thought. I couldn't imagine that you would be able to have a sustainable system where the actually energy source itself is causing a degradation of the walls and so on of the containment vessels. Now, I have had 20 years of exposure to engineers since then, a lot through my Patreon supporters, of course, but also through people I know through academic circles. And they've convinced me that the modern technologies in nuclear reactors are far safer than they used to be and need far less regulation costs because of that safety. And the real thing is if we can actually pump them out the same way we pump out ships, for example, out of a shipyard, rather than having to custom build each one and going through an enormous regulatory hoops as well, that it's quite possible this would be much safer than, certainly safer than coal, because we know the extent to which coal leads to health problems, leads to deaths and so on, far more deaths from coal-fired power stations than nuclear in their entire history. So it's a long-winded answer, but basically I'm in favour of nuclear. My question marks come down to how fast we can roll it out. But even on that front, I've had some of my colleagues on Patreon tell me that they think that we could, within 10 years, with a concerted effort to build modern nuclear power stations, it would be feasible to have them replacing that 85% that's fossil fuel based in a matter of a decade. I still think there's got to be resource constraints. There've got to be problems about scaling up the production of those facilities that rapidly. But the overall argument, the energy density of nuclear is so much higher than anything else we've ever used, including oil, that if we can find a way of tapping it technologically successfully, then it gives the high density energy that was really the basis of developing Western civilization ever since we discovered coal and oil.
So the argument against nuclear, very often, apart from those concerns about what you do with the waste fuel and all that, is the cost of it. So and because it's expensive. Now it's interesting, isn't it? Because in the UK, there was talk about having it partially funded by a Chinese business, Chinese investment company that's basically owned by the Chinese government. So Chinese government created money was going to create a nuclear power station in Britain, whereas we could just create it with government money ourselves. The expense argument, if we accept the fact that governments can create money, sort of goes away, doesn't it? Unless it's using resources which are very scarce. The only issue is that we expect the private sector to supply so much of our fuel that it would be unfair for the government to step in and say, well, okay, we're going to fund this thing that's going to replace what you're making money out of. But then that raises the fundamental question, doesn't it? Should you allow the private sector to be responsible for supplying the energy for a nation?
Well, it also comes down to some of the simply accounting issues involved here, because if you've got to borrow the cost of capital of a corporation and you've got something which is going to have a 30-year, 40-year life and a long construction lead time as well, it ends up being that the cost of finance alone is the major reason why it's expensive. If you did the same thing where the government could simply say, well, you're budgeting for the X amount of money for a nuclear power station this year, and it's not paying, not borrowing, it's not paying the borrowing costs, then that makes the public provision much cheaper than the private. And you can get the private sector and they're saying, okay, we will pay the private sector to do it if necessary. If you find there's a private firm that's better at building nuclear reactors than the government itself, you finance it with government money, but you avoid the cost of finance and drastically reduce the cost that way.
Well, yeah, and it could be as simple as, and we were talking about this last week, weren't we? What they're doing in the United States. Let's just create a $1 trillion coin. So it's going to cost $1 trillion for a nuclear power station. Someone's going to build it for us. We'll get that coin over to you this afternoon, just as soon as we've minted it.
Well, over to the central bank, and then the central bank will send you $1 trillion in £1 trillion in British notes. Yeah. So that's the real way it works. But yeah, it's something where the cost of finance and the cost of regulation are. And again, I'm going from my engineers tell me the major factor in the high cost of nuclear, and it's feasible to have much, much lower cost nuclear, probably competitive with solar. The difference is that the sheer density of the energy means we can use the current distribution system we have for electric power, whereas if you do solar and you try to have solar on the roof and connect it to the grid, you can do it, but you're effectively trying to pump water from your house up to the dam, whereas the system was designed for the water to flow from the dam to your house. So the infrastructure we have at the moment for distributing electricity is much better suited to having a high power site, which then pumps the power down to the users rather than the reverse direction, which is what's required for a standard solar connected to the grid running from people's personal installations.
Although, I mean, there are people talking about, you know, this idea of local mesh networks where everyone's got solar and other forms of creating energy and you share it amongst your neighbourhood. But I've always thought that sounds like a neat idea because we can equate it with the internet. But the trouble is you don't
because the internet, I mean, the other thing with the internet is, internet is global. Your network is local. And if there's a cloud over your house, there's a cloud over your neighbor's house and the energy level drops. So you have all these issues about the amount of extra capacity you need to cover the fact that solar is, you know, for half the year, less than 12 hours a day. Mm. Intermittent, not at all at night, et cetera. Then you have to have more capacity. You've got to have battery storage. The hassle about energy is that the demand has to be almost identical to the supply, or vice versa. Yeah. Supply has to be identical to the demand, and that makes much harder to handle than another commodity where you can actually store it in a warehouse for a while. When it's not sold, it doesn't degrade.
So the interconnectedness happens better at a global scale. So if you have those high-intensity creators of energy and they are interconnected globally so that perhaps you can manage capacity on that basis. Or maybe you don't need to if the amount of power generated is so huge. But it's the global level, isn't it, what you're saying? And I was thinking, imagine if you actually just had the internet and you're told, well, actually the internet is very local. You can only get web pages that have been created within 25 miles of you, which would be great for people living locally here because they get the Steve Keen podcast, which might be the only distraction they get from the Surrey County Council website, which would be just about the only other thing on the internet. So thank God it is global. So interconnectedness, is that important or not? It's just the creation of energy that... Because part of the reason I raised that was because this whole interconnectedness thing was part of the reason that Margaret Thatcher said that we need to privatise the energy industry in the UK so there is more competition and more international competition. So we're going to bring, build links that really didn't exist to Europe so we could play on the international markets. With this crazy idea back then, that Britain would be a net creator and we would be exporting so much energy to the rest of the world. That was the reason that Britain wanted to be connected. As it turns out, we are having to get vast quantities of the energy that we consume comes from overseas. A lot of it comes from Russia. So as to the competition, because the idea was, more competition would mean that there would be more innovation. That's that argument that's always given. And so we went from six big energy companies to over 70 individual suppliers, but most of them are marketing companies, that are buying wholesale and selling retail and not hedging enough, and therefore they've all been falling, a few a day during this crisis. So they've got basically a call center and a billing system. So that's not really, competition in the true sense, and certainly it's not work, because look what's happening. They're falling by the wayside. You could argue they were keeping prices artificially low because they weren't doing stuff like storing energy. And that, there's another thing as well. So because everyone was focused on selling the stuff, people were less concerned about generating it because that's more complicated, and certainly weren't worrying about stuff like, building up reserves. So Centrica, which owned British Gas when it was privatised, had a big storage facility off the Yorkshire coast, but it became unsafe and it was too expensive for them to repair, so they closed it. So back then we had 9 or 10 days of gas storage in the UK. Now we're down to just a few days. So that, all those things which are expensive become a concern, and the private industry isn't too concerned about it because that's sort of like a long-term, one-in-50-year event. We're just concerned about how much money we're going to get tomorrow.
And this has actually been the experience of privatizing energy virtually everywhere, because the whole idea was, it's the whole myth of supply and demand, just let the market set it and everything's going to be perfect. But because electricity demand is so volatile, and you can overload because we design the system to be close to the capacity needs, you don't have a lot of overhead. And then if there's a period of increased demand, then the need for energy can overwhelm the capacity of the system, and you get a huge price spike. So in Australia, I had a guy I was in touch with for some time who was actually involved in designing the electricity market there, and he asked me a little question at one stage. He said, "How many hours do you ring per year? Do you reckon firms make their profit?" And I'll save you trying to guess. The answer was about six, because there were 6 hours of the, this may be 6 days it may have been, but a trivial part of the entire year, where the energy prices per kilowatt were over $1,000. And if you weren't operating for those particular hours, if you happen to have your station offline at that stage, you'd lose money for the whole year. So the volatility was so great that the idea was they were going to, having deregulated, privatised and made competitive the price setting in the wholesale market, they're going to then transfer that to the retail market. But they realised if they did it, it's quite possible you could, you know, have a cold night and Granny turns the two-bar radiator on and wakes up in the morning with a $2,000 bill for staying warm overnight. And they realised they simply couldn't do it at the retail level. So we've never seen the flow through to the retail section having the same price volatility as applies in the wholesale.
Well, you and as you are providing something where there is a base demand, and say that sometimes that demand might increase by 10%, and but only for very short periods of time, you're not going to build for those periods when the demand increases above the base amount, because it's going to cost you too much and you're not going to get enough back from it.
So, or you're going to charge an enormous price for it, and then causes instability through the whole system, which is what you're seeing right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that is, yeah. And look, you know, let's look at that, because in March 2021, you know, not that long ago, the average price of gas per therm, T-H-E-R-M, I'm not, there's a definition of what a therm is. I think it's how much power is needed to boil water or something, I don't know. But anyway,
this is called a British thermal unit, isn't it, BTU?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, but yeah. What is it exactly? But anyway, whatever it is, it was 40 pence in March 2021. In October, it had risen to 400 pence, so a tenfold increase. And, you know, you could say, well, that's just market forces. You have to live with it. In fact, that is pretty much what Boris Johnson is saying. That's his reaction to all of this. He obviously thinks it's up to the markets to decide. But, you know, there's old people who are not going to be able to pay their heating bills in Britain this winter because of that. And to make it worse, I mean, the answer from the government is, well, we've got an energy price gap. So cap, I should say. So if you use 2,900 kilowatt hours of electricity and 12,000 kilowatt hours of gas, the cap is set at £1,277 per year, which is a £139 increase on the year before. So I'm not quite sure. I think it's a very small percentage. So a small increase in that cap, but a big increase in, you know, a tenfold increase in just a few months in the wholesale price. So what you've got there is a lack of supply, or very expensive supply, and a retail price that is going up a little bit, but not a great deal. That is not going to change consumer behavior, is it? So people will keep on using that power, even though the supply is being short, is falling or becoming more expensive.
Yeah, so, it's one of a market fantasy failed in an extremely complicated industry. Where, I mean, Richard Dennis in Australia makes a good line about this. He talks about all these different companies marketing identical electrons and charging different ways you can pay for exactly the same electron. So there's it is all marketing. It has got nothing. The product has to be moving electrons. That's what you're getting. You're fluctuating or direct kind of, that's your choice. Whether they fluctuate or they go in a line. That's the only differentiation you can give with the actual end result of electric power. But we put all this, you know, huge market complication on top of it. And of course, it's got that unique feature. You're saying you can't have a buffer for electricity in the same sense you have a buffer for goods like, for products like wheat or sugar or flour or any other consumer product which can be stored in a warehouse.
Yeah. I wonder how Margaret Thatcher would be seeing this situation now, given that she was the one who privatised the energy markets in the UK, you know, as I said, to engender competition that Boris Johnson is happily seeing destroyed right now. But as you're saying, to that point, the companies being destroyed are just marketing companies. So no one's going to get too upset about less marketing companies on the planet. But the concern is, isn't it, that the infrastructure is what's falling by the wayside, because it's being driven by marketing people rather than engineers now.
Yeah, and it worked better when you let the engineers run the damn thing. This is the whole idea that you had an engineering-oriented industry. You were trying to provide the energy needed for industry and for consumption. You weren't worried about the profitability so much. You wanted to cover your costs, but you have a basic markup on your costs for the sale price. And your whole focus is on the industrial infrastructure. And now it's all on the marketing. We've forgotten the infrastructure. Like you mentioned, that oil storage, the gas storage site being shut down. And then consequently, all you've got left is the marketing, which means volatile prices, but you don't have the physical capability to supply the energy.
Yeah. If you were a commercial company and you said, well, okay, I'm just going to keep the reserves. So it's harder with electricity, obviously, but with gas you can store it. I don't know how long for. But if you say, well, okay, I can store all this stuff, and then when supply runs short, I'll wait till the last possible moment till everyone's really suffering, and then I'm going to charge a mozza for it. You would have thought that would be a commercial model. I mean, I'm sure that was the belief, wasn't it, when it was all privatized. Someone would do that because they're going to make money out of that situation, and that's going to help balance out the market. But the fact is, no one has been doing it. Those reserves have been falling. Britain's now stuffed.
How stuck is Britain? I mean, this is asking from the outside. What is the impact on, is energy prices rising, or is there energy just not being available?
Well, the wholesale price has gone up 10 times, Steve. Is that enough for you?
The retail price hasn't,
because of the energy cap.
Mm,
so that's my point, that the companies are going under because they can't charge more. So there's, some companies are saying, well, we've hedged really well, but hedged to the extent that you're expecting prices to rise tenfold?
No
one really knows. And so there's a couple of things happening here. One is that, it's the perfect storm in the alternative sources of energy creation. So it's not just, gas being pumped to your house. It's obviously gas-powered power stations as well. And there's no alternative sources because wind, for example, it's been the worst year for wind in the UK. So
Boris Johnson in charge.
Even if there's a way we could tap his speeches and power, and if we could find a way to tap into Boris Johnson's speeches like the one he gave at the Conservative Party conference, and we could tap that energy and use it for the good of the British people, then that would be fabulous. Uncanny, isn't it? but no, we can't do that. But so even with that, so no wind, and obviously we've got petrol prices rising as well. So it's and then the factor in all of this is Vladimir Putin has been cutting supply, not been supplying as much to Europe as well. And there's only one pipeline, I think, which links the Europe. There might be two. One of them went offline, I think. So there's a shortage
of energy itself, yeah.
Shortage from the source, and then how it's interconnected back into Britain as well. So that's gone up, and the alternatives are also expensive. So all of these factors at the same time, and then the fact that we haven't got any reserves. So I think someone was saying we've got at any one time we've got the capability to store just a couple of days or 3 days of gas supplies. So it's real time stuff. So the moment there's any supply disruption, you feel it straight away.
Yeah, so, that's what I was actually getting at, because my focus comes into how well does economics understand energy, and the answer is virtually not at all.
Mm.
And I was looking for a particular illustration of this just in some work I've been doing on the climate change and how neoclassicals have stuffed that up, and their idea of modelling production is to say you have capital and labor in, goods out the other end. No role for energy, no role for raw materials. But I've finally found one paper where the person modified their production function to include labor and capital and energy. And then they did the standard old way that they do it. They gave a coefficient that they raised capital to a power, which was equivalent to the capital share of GDP, which is about 0.3. They raised labor to the labor share, which is about 0.665. And they raised energy to what was left, which was pretty much based on the share of energy as a percentage of GDP. And their coefficient at that time was 0.03. Now, My little calculation was, if you use this model as a guide to what's going to happen if there's a drop in the amount of energy available, let's say we had, let's say a little catastrophe takes out, I don't know, Belgium, okay, where, you know, AMOC disappears, gigantic storm, Belgium gets wiped from the map, you know, to throw in Netherlands and Luxembourg for good measure, they're all gone, and think, holy shit, this is serious, we've got to cut back to just use energy which doesn't put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. How much of the drop would there be in energy supply? The answer is about 85%. What does economic theory tell you will happen to production if you have an 85% fall in energy supplies? The answer is production will fall by 5%.
Right. The logic for that being?
Which is absolutely, the logic being that they lose this tiny coefficient for energy of 0.03. So, you know, you're raising it to that tiny power, a gigantic change in energy has a trivial impact on your prediction of output. And what I've been, you know, with my work has been saying, well, it's crazy to regard energy as an independent input to production. You've got to put energy into machines and into labor for them to work. So rather than having energy times labor times capital, which is the way the neoclassicals do it, I'd have energy as an input to capital and energy as an input to labor. And then you can use the labor and capital coefficients. That ends up giving you a coefficient for the energy input of a machine 10 times as high as the neoclassicals use. So even with the other coefficients they use, where they give a higher coefficient to labor than they do to capital, simply based on labor, workers earn more of a national output than capitalists do. So workers get about 65%, capitalists get about 35%. We're feeding in that number, I get with a 95% fall in energy input, you get not a 5% fall, which is a neoclassical prediction, but a 44% fall, which is a bit more serious. And then if you take a look at the Leontief way of modeling and saying, look, output is just proportional to capital, when you feed that in, you get, if you have a 85% fall in energy, you have an 85% fall in output. So what you're seeing, you've got nothing like that level of fall happening in your energy supplies. We're talking about a 2 or 3, maybe 5% fall in energy supplies. But you're seeing serious disruptions in the UK economy from that level. And economic theory, if you say, oh, you won't even notice.
Yeah, but we are noticing it. And, you know, there's
absolutely, because it's real.
It's real. And, you know, there are talks that, in fact, in reality, the best we're going to get away with at the retail level, you know, because they're going to have to change the price cap, but the best we're going to get away with is that your energy bill doubles. And then the flow-on effect from that is there's nursing homes saying, well, we can't survive. There's companies that are intensive energy users, like making bricks, for example, who are already saying, well, we're having to close now because we can't afford to keep operating. So there's a very real flow-on effect. So that case, which will provide, you know, Britain is being a petri dish in so many ways during this this COVID crisis.
What a good expression for it, yeah.
Yeah, well, we are.
It's where you grow diseases.
We grow, yeah, exactly. And we are, you know, the rest of the world can watch and learn from all of this. So the transition to green. So the one thing, you know, Boris Johnson has been very, very big on is trying to say, you know, we need to move very quickly to alternative energy sources. And he's very big on wind, for example. But the problem with transitioning to green energy, which obviously we should do, is that companies, if it's not nationalized, energy companies will be saying, well, okay, we know there's no way in the world we want to invest in fossil fuels because the government is there subsidizing alternative energy sources. They want to change behavior. You know, that's just going to stymie investment, which might be a good thing, but in the short term, it creates this big problem where you don't have the capacity to service the nation. So, yeah, there's got to be a plan to transition from one to the other, and it seems like that doesn't exist.
Oh, you know, if we actually wanted to get to the 2030 and net zero by 2030, which is what's being spoken about at COP26 in a matter of months' time, then you'd need to increase the rate of rollout of renewables and other energy forms like nuclear by a factor of 5 or 10. So there's no way we're on target to meet those reductions, and that means we're going to continue pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And it also means that where we have resources where we're already starting to exhaust the physical supplies, and that's supplying with oil, pardon me, just knocked over a pair of scissors then, that's supplying with oil, then the cost of production of oil is going up, and also gas, and that feeds back into your difficulties. So it means massive economic disruption and nothing like meeting the target of net zero by 2030.
Well, and, you know, potentially we take a step back. So I've heard people saying, oh, well, yeah, we're going to turn the wood burners back on again. You know, the people are, you know, starting to burn wood chips because it's the cheapest way of heating their house. So, you know, which is making the situation worse. Will we start burning coal again because it's cheaper than buying gas, for example? So, you know, as this energy crisis hits, people are going to look for the cheapest way and be less concerned about being green if it's a question between keeping the house warm or not.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why our blindness to the role of energy in production has been such a critical failing of economic theory and also, therefore, government policy. We've taken the level of energy we consume for granted. And we also tend to think that we don't realize that a large part of the increase in wealth we've enjoyed is the increase in energy consumption. You know, the amount of energy that we consume on a daily basis probably would have made a king weep 200 years earlier. I think it was Buckminster Fuller who gave us the idea of the geodesic domes and concepts like that. He talked about us all having energy slaves and relying upon the energy slaves without even realizing they existed. And then one day we're going to run out of energy slaves. And it may be that this, again, is a bit of a canary in the coal mine for the UK, that the problems aren't just, you know, particular policies in the UK. It's starting to reach the limits of particularly gas and oil in fossil fuel production, while we're also reaching the limits of what we can pump into the atmosphere in terms of carbon dioxide that those same fuels generate. So we're beginning a serious energy crunch, and you guys are showing us what it looks like.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks for pleased to be of service. So can it all be done? This transition to a greener future, if we've got a whole load of private companies. I mean, isn't it? We've shown that, you know, if you've got a privatized energy industry, then it becomes a fight between marketing companies to offer the lowest price or to disguise the price anyway, so the consumer's confused. And by the way, here you've got to change your energy provider every year because they'll move you onto a more expensive plan. So everyone spends their life switching energy providers.
Oh my God!
It's just craziness. Whereas you wouldn't have that if you just had one state provider. But also they've shown that they're not investing in the infrastructure to provide a reliable continuous supply of energy, and that's become very evident as well. So all the more reason for that, you know, it should be renationalized. But then the biggest argument for that would be this fact that, you know, if you're going to move to renewables, it does need to be a coordinated policy, doesn't it? Because you're going to go through this process where the investment is just not going to be there for the old technology, but you're still going to need it until you've got the new technology. So the private sector can't maintain that. You've got to have government money right across the board. You've got to have a coordinated policy, which you're not going to get from disparate providers.
Yeah, and I think you know, this whole problem of privatizing was presuming a nice stable future with no climate change issues and with no serious disruptions. But this, we've got them both coming on in spades. So to me the real worry is our dependence upon energy is so enormous that the change in energy at the global level correlates with a change in GDP at a level of 0.8. So if you look at the variation in GDP and variation in energy, they're virtually the same line. So if we have a decline in energy availability, we're going to have a decline in GDP. And that is something which nobody's factoring, or not nobody, but nobody in power is factoring in. There's a presumption we continue having rising energy and therefore rising GDP without realizing the link between the two. But if energy starts to become a scarce resource and we find we can't produce as much as we'd like because of the carbon dioxide issues anyway, then there's going to be a necessary economic slowdown coming out.
And we'll check back in a year to see how Britain can provide the data to support that argument. But the other side of it all as well is if you are allowing private companies to run energy, you have private companies looking after the good of a nation competing against the politics, the geopolitics. So part of the problem here in the UK is that Russia supplies a lot of European and UK gas. Vladimir Putin is basically there to decide how much is sold. Bizarrely, Europe moved off a long-term contract pricing for those supplies with Russia to spot pricing. So guess what?
A deliberate move by the British.
Yeah. So when supply falls, prices rise. Whereas you could have contracted your way through this, and then Vladimir would have kept on pumping because, you know, there's a contract price. And if there's a contract price, the more you sell at that price, the better off you are. But if you don't have that contract price, then yeah, just hold back the supply and push the price up, you know, as evidenced by, you know, the way the oil oligopoly works. So, but also the interesting thing is, you know, surprisingly, he's just finished building his Nord Stream 2 pipeline so that he can pump more gas to Europe. So Europe becomes more self-sufficient, more dependent, I should say, on Russia. They finished it a month ago. And now they just need Germany to basically ratify it, provide the certification for it so they can turn it on. So there's something going on here, isn't there? Russia playing hardball to show, you know, how much there is this need for this pipeline for extra capacity. So they hold Europe to ransom until they approve it so Russia can then turn it on. Seems like a big coincidence that this pipeline finished in September and here we are suddenly needing gas in October, doesn't it? So there's politics at play here.
And global power, this particular one, not that I'm going to the rights or the wrongs, but I'd back Vladimir Putin over his rivals any day on how well the politics has played out.
So, all right, well, where are we? We need to get it back in government hands, don't we, fairly quickly. And there needs to be a policy of transition faster than we are seeing. And we seem to be saying nuclear should be part of that as well. And the cost of it's not a concern because governments can create the money to pay for it.
And also because the main costs are the interest rates on long-term funding, which the private sector needs and the government doesn't. So, yeah, in some ways we need a dramatic rollout of the physical infrastructure to produce energy, both where that is non-coal-based, non-carbon dioxide-based, and we've left it very, very late, and consequently leaving it very, very late to do it. We probably will fail to do it in time, so we'll have an energy crunch coming our way over the next decade, and that will mean dramatically rising prices, which will undermine any private system. It's only a government provision system which could provide the finance without needing to worry about making a profit.
Right, but the argument would be, well, if the government does it, then you're losing that innovation from the private sector and also the investment opportunities for the private sector. But you're basically saying, well, you know, because the investment community can find other things to invest in. There's loads of other things. Just don't touch energy because that's too crucial for the GDP of the nation.
No, you touch it. You do it to a government contract. That's the thing.
Yeah. All right, very good. Excellent. We've not sorted it, but we know what the problem is. We know how we got here. Good to talk, Steve. Catch you again soon.
Okay, Matt. Bye.
It's another dimension, isn't it, as we come out of COVID-19, something that we never predicted, that there would be this energy crunch, which is hitting the UK and Europe particularly so much right now. We'll catch you again next week for another edition of the Debunking Economics Podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.